Welcome to episode 71 of our podcast, Two Chairs Talking. My name is David Grigg, and I'm joined as always by my co-host, Perry Middlemiss. I've run out of funny adjectives for you, Perry. I'll just have to try harder next time. How are you, Perry?
Oh, good, thank you. Yes, I'm getting about the same. I think I might have to give that whole idea a bit of a miss from now on.
I think it was so. It'd make life easier if we don't...
Well, I was struggling a little. I was sort of trying to find...
You've plumbed every language in the world, I think, haven't you?
Well, I've got there, yes. Well, I tried as much best I could, but we weren't getting very far. But anyway, away from the mundane, boring bits about, you know, reading words, though that's basically what we do most of the time... I'm fine, thank you, David. Overall,
you're good.
Pretty well. Got through the end of summer without broiling, which is okay.
Yes, that's true.
It was a rather humid summer, but yes. Not overly hot, which is appreciated.
In Melbourne, at least, we didn't get the huge flooding and things they've had in Sydney, thank goodness.
No.
Yeah, they've had it tough.
Nor did we get major bushfires, nor did we get 40 degrees Celsius on any day, I don't think. We had a couple of warm ones.
Count that as a win.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. But otherwise, everything's pretty good, hunky-dory.
Indeed, and we were able to catch up the other day, which was with a few of our friends, which was very pleasant.
Oh, yes, face-to-face meetings are now starting again. Well, that's a bit of a shock after a couple of years, isn't it? Now you can actually sit there and think, I can actually plan to go and have a quiet beer or a meal with somebody, and as long as I'm careful, if there's too many people around, I'm wearing a mask. And I certainly would wear it on public transport.
Oh, yeah.
I was at the cinema last night and didn't wear it there. I didn't feel uncomfortable about it, even though it was a reasonably full cinema. I thought it was a reasonable place, and I thought we were going to be okay. So,
Good stuff.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Now, do we have any news on the science fictional fanish front?
Well, not so much the fanish front for me, but I've got a bit of news on some literary awards which might be of interest. The first of these is the 2022 International Thriller Writers Awards, which is given out by the International Thriller Writers, which seems like a reasonable thing. Now, the interesting thing about this one is that in 2021, the major winners were both had a major Australian connection. The best hardcover novel last year was Adrian McKinty's The Chain, which we talked about on this podcast. And the best paperback original novel was Dervla McTiernan's The Scholar, which we also talked about
on this
particular podcast. So that was a good representation last year for all things Australian. Not so good this year. I've had a bit of a check through and I can't find anything. Nothing that stands out for me. So I'll just give you the best hardcover novels and see whether you recognise any of these names. Megan Abbott for The Turnout. I've heard of Megan Abbott, but I don't think I've read anything by her.
No.
S.A. Cosby, Razorblade Tears. Well, I'll actually be talking about that novel a bit later on in this particular podcast, so that's all right. Alice Feeney, Rock, Paper, Scissors. Rachel Housel Hall, These Toxic Things. Alma Katsu for Red Window, and Eric Rickstad for I Am Not Who You Think I Am.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, yep. So there's a few names there that are unfamiliar to me, but that's always good because having some unfamiliar names means that it's a possibility you might find one of those really good authors floating around out there that you'd never come across before that this particular award may have raised a flag for you.
Mm.
You never know. It's just the way it is. Next piece of news, the long list for the 2022 Stella Prize has been announced. This one, of course, is the prize for writing by Australian women. Bit of a change this year. This is the long list, and the note on the website says the 2022 Stella Prize long list includes novels, short fiction, memoir, social history, a book-length essay, a graphic novel, and eligible for the first time in 2022 poetry collections.
Yes, I saw that, yeah.
So there's 12 or so on the long list, which I think they'll chop down to about 5 or 6, and that should come out in about a month, and then I think the announcement of the winner will be about a month after that. So that's something to look forward to. We've picked up a couple of the Stella Prize winners over the last couple of years and had some very interesting discussions about them.
We have.
I think we shall try to do the same this year when we have a winner.
Sure. I might wait for the shortlist there, I think, before,
tackling it. Yeah. Oh, yeah, there's too many on the too many on that for us to do, to do all the other things that we want to do and catch up with our own reading and it goes on and on. Yeah. So, no, we'll hold off until we look at the shortlist and then we'll actually go wait for the winner, I think, and then read the winner.
Yeah.
But we'll see what happens. Other bit of news, the shortlist for the BSFA, that's the British Science Fiction Association Awards, have been announced. These are awards that will be presented at the British National Convention at Easter, referred to as EasterCon. They generally just do best novel, best short fiction, best non-fiction, a few other fantasy things as well. I'll just give you the best novel, because these are science fiction novels. Yep. I think they're novels published in the last year in the United Kingdom.
Yep.
So the best novels are A Desolation Called Peace by Arkady Martin. That's a sequel to her Hugo-winning novel, A Memory Called Empire, which I greatly enjoyed. And I have a copy of this, and it's on my list to read if I can get there, but I will get there at some point. Blackthorn Winter by Liz Williams. Purgatory Mount by Adam Roberts. Adam Roberts' stuff is always worth reading.
Sure.
Shards of Earth by Adrian Tchaikovsky, who's also very much worth reading. Hmm. Skyward Inn by Aaliyah Whiteley, and Green Man's Challenge by Juliet E. McKenna. There's three authors on there I know and three I don't. Hmm. So time to spread my wings a little bit, David, I think,
and
have a look at some of those. So that's the end of my news just at this stage. So, that's all we've got. There's always awards news just about every week.
Oh, goodness me, there is, yes.
Every episode will always have something.
Yep.
And so we'll always have bits and pieces to catch up on.
Indeed.
That's right.
Indeed.
Yep, good.
All right, well, I believe that we're going to talk about crime again this episode. So we'll deal with quite a number of crime novels and indeed a piece of crime television based on a novel that we know about. So we'll talk about that later. So do you want to head off, Perry, and start this rolling?
All right, I will do that. First book I want to talk about is titled The Dark Remains. This is written by William McIlvaney and Ian Rankin, published in 2021. I gave this one 3.9 out of 5, and I shall explain why. This forms part of McIlvaney's Laidlaw series of novels, the first of which, called Laidlaw, I discussed on the podcast last year or early this year, I think.
Mm-hmm.
When William McIlvaney died in 2015, he left behind a lot of notes for different particular ideas and particular novels. And one that caught the eye of the executors was notes on a novel he intended to write, which would be a prequel to his well-regarded Laidlaw series of police procedural crime novels set in Glasgow in the early 1970s. So this was going to be one that he was going to write, but unfortunately he passed away before he got to it. Now, the executors, his literary executors, decided that they would approach Ian Rankin, who is the author of the John Rebus series of novels set in Edinburgh, to see whether he would be interested in completing this particular novel. And this book is the result. Rankin was quite chuffed about the whole idea of doing this because just before he had his first novel published, he went to a writer's event somewhere where McIlvaney was speaking, probably in Edinburgh, and spoke to him and said that he was just about to publish his first detective novel, the first of the John Rebus books, set in Edinburgh. And McIlvaney signed a copy of his book, whichever one it was that was around at that time. Good luck and hope things work out. Over the years, it worked out very, very well for Ian Rankin, incredibly well for Ian Rankin, and he became a very close friend of William McIlvaney's, and the executives basically told Rankin that McIlvaney, before he had died, had said that if anybody wanted to carry on with any of this stuff, Rankin was probably the best of them to do that, and yes, he is. So anyway, to the novel itself. This book is set in October 1972 in Glasgow, and That city is ruled by competing crime gangs, and when the second in command of one of those gangs is found murdered, the city threatens to turn into a bloodbath, as it does, because he's found murdered on the territory of somebody else. So it looks like he's gone to that particular place for a meeting and been murdered there, probably by the other gang. So there's obviously this lot of tension building up between these two gangs. Detective Sergeant Laidlaw is put onto the case and quickly gets everybody's noses out of joint. Not only the gangsters, but also his own bosses and everybody else. This is just the way that he is. I mean, if you've read any of the other three novels in the series, there's only three, unfortunately, but there's three. Laidlaw is very recognisable if you've read any of them. He drifts around the city using his contacts to extract the information that he's looking for, travels on buses or walks places, doesn't really like going around in cars very much. He chain smokes, drinks over lunchtime, and he lives in a seedy city hotel despite having a house in the suburbs with a wife and child, because he says that when he's on a case, he likes to basically be able to concentrate completely on this particular case. Now, looking at this particular character from the perspective of 2022, you sort of think, this is a bit cliched, we've seen all this stuff before. But you have to realise, Laidlaw was written before the little clichés were around. He was one of the early ones that got really started in this particular style. Laidlaw has his problems, but he's still very much an excellent police officer. And the way that Laidlaw used to write his stories, he really wasn't big on plot. It was much more about the setting and the characters walking through the setting. And you know what you're going to get in this particular book, and also what you're going to get from the Laidlaw stuff. But in this particular book, the first sentences read as follows. All cities are riddled with crime. It comes with the territory. Gather enough people together in one place and malignancy is guaranteed to manifest in some form or other. That's perfectly true for all of these crime novels. This is a gritty version of Glasgow in the 1970s. I never went there in the 1970s. The first time I went there was in 1987. And it wasn't a very nice place in 1987, 15 years later. So I would be thinking that in 1972, with a lot of problems with unemployment, industries shutting down all over the place, it would not have been a very nice place at all. Anyway, back to the novel. Ian Rankin has done a really good job of transferring his eye for the city environment to Glasgow from his native Edinburgh with this one. And in many ways, you could be really forgiven for thinking that this was written by McIlvaney alone. There's obviously a labour of love for Rankin, and it really does show. Now, I suppose you'd ask the question, can you tell which bits are McIlvaney's and which are Rankin's? And I'd have to say, frankly, no, I can't. Some of the plot twists seem more Rankin than McIlvaney, but I wouldn't want to bet that Rankin has just sort of beefed up some of the plot twists a bit, some of the little subplots. But the feel of the book is a perfect McIlvaney feel for what happens. And Rankin basically has hit the character of Laidlaw directly on the head. He's got it completely. So if you like tartan noir, the Scottish sort of style of, Val McDermott, what's called tartan noir? Okay. You've got the Rankin McDermott of Val McDermott. You've got what's the name of that guy up in Aberdeen? Anyway, you've got a number of them that are basically doing a heck of a lot of good work coming out of Scotland. If you like the tartan noir and want some idea where it all started, then McIlvaney is your man, and basically Rankin's his successor. So you've got double here, and it comes across as a. This is a crime novel where you're more interested in the setting of Glasgow and the characters that move through its streets rather than the plot of the crime itself. Mm. Because frankly, it's sort of, once you get into it a bit, you start thinking, oh, hang on. There's a lot of don't look here, don't look here, don't look here going on. Yeah. So you think, maybe I should look over the other way. Oh, look, maybe that's what happened. Mm. And that's where you figure out what's going on. So the plot's not revelatory. It's not something that we haven't necessarily seen of that style before, but let me tell you, the book itself is excellent because it does look at the city and the people, and that's good enough, I reckon. So there we are. That was a good one.
It must be quite hard to pick up another author's style convincingly and do it well. It's been done a few times. I'm thinking of the lady who finished the Peter Wimsey series of books, Jill Peyton Walsh. She did a pretty good job with that. And I've also got read it a long time ago. I've got a completion of Charles Dickens's The Mystery of Edwin Drood, which was completed, which was left half finished at Dickens's death, and was completed by Leon Garfield. And in the book, there's no indication at all where one writer leaves off and the other starts, and I couldn't tell at all. I had to go back and refer to the original copies of Dickens's book to actually figure out where Garfield picked up. So he did a very good job. Not an easy to do.
While I was looking at this particular book and having a bit of research and reading around it to see how the combination of McIlvaney and Rankin came together, it was actually mentioned that your old favourite, Wilkie Collins, was approached to write the ending for The Mystery of Edwin Drood and
No, that's interesting. It's
refused.
not surprising. Yeah, no, he probably would actually
Yeah,
refuse, but
he
yeah.
wasn't. I don't know why he refused, but he refused, and that's his choice, that's fine.
Yeah, Collins's style was a fair bit different from Dickens, I think. So probably you probably
Probably
recognise
for,
he couldn't do a really good job. But
yeah,
yeah,
probably
anyway.
a bridge too far. Leon Garfield, I've read a few books of his. He wrote, didn't he write Hopscotch? And I think he may have written, no, I won't say what else he's written. I'm pretty certain
He
he
was
wrote,
mainly a
is it?
children's writer, young adult writer.
Yeah, but he also wrote a few thrillers as well that are
Oh,
from the
yeah, that's
1970s that I
new to me. I didn't
believe
know
I've
that.
got. So I thought, yep, it's pretty good. I may have a quick look and see what's there.
I should check that out. I didn't know that he wrote adult novels too. So I'm going to roll on to my book, next book, which was The Housemate by Sarah Bailey. Now, Sarah Bailey has written a trilogy based around the police detective Gemma Woodstock, and they were all good. The first one in particular, The Dark Lake, I thought was excellent, and the second and third were pretty good, but not really as strong as the first. Anyway, in The Housemate, we have a completely different main character, whose name is Olive Groves, believe it or not, who everyone calls Ollie. And she isn't with the police, but she's not a detective, but in fact she's a journalist with a fictional Melbourne newspaper. Now, you have to go back in time now, because 10 years before the main action of the book, Ollie was a young reporter attending a crime scene where Evelyn, one of three young women sharing a house together, had been stabbed to death. And the crime there is quickly pinned on one of the other housemates, Alex, who's a female. Who was covered in Evelyn's blood and whose fingerprints are on the knife which killed her. And the third housemate, Nicole, went missing, and the police believe that Alex somehow must have killed her earlier on and disposed of the body somewhere that they haven't ever been able to discover. Okay, so that was 10 years ago. Olive is now a senior reporter at her current newspaper, and one morning she's startled to be told by her editor that Nicole, the missing housemate, has apparently turned up. But she's not alive. She's hanging from a tree, apparently having committed suicide somewhere in a little township up in the Dandenongs. So where's she been for 10 years, and why has she now just decided to end it all? So Ollie's assigned to this new story, and she's told, much against her will, that she has to team up with a young man called Cooper Ng, I don't know ever how you pronounce that Vietnamese name, Cooper Ng, who is a technical whiz who's preparing to launch a podcast for the newspaper, and who managed to get an exclusive interview with Alex just before she was released from prison. Now, Ollie finds him at first extremely irritating and unprofessional, but eventually they settle into this sort of working relationship. And together they slowly start to uncover the secrets concealed by the three housemates 10 years ago. They seem apparently to have had a good deal more money than could easily be explained by these three young women who were students and just having casual jobs. But eventually, Ollie and Cooper reveal a dark conspiracy at work. So Like Gemma Woodstock in the earlier books by Bailey, Ollie has a complicated personal life. She's now living with a man called Dean Yardley, who has got two primary school-aged daughters who are not very impressed by Ollie. And their mother, his first wife, was Detective Sergeant Isabel Yardley, who was the lead investigator in the original housemates case. But she's been dead for a couple of years, having been killed in a hit-and-run incident while out jogging. Now, Dean Yardley is a very controlling man, and Ollie's relationship with him is constantly under tension as she tries to juggle her stressful job at the same time as his ongoing demands for her to give him attention. And eventually she starts to wonder if he had some involvement in his previous wife's death, and perhaps even somehow in the housemate's case. So the author spins all this into a very interesting story with many plot twists and turns, which definitely kept me reading. I do have to say that there seemed to be a number of loose ends which were wrapped up too quickly and, for me, unconvincingly at the end of the book. There were a couple of plot threads in particular which I thought were just dismissed far too easily by explaining that this particular character had just been lying. And you sort of think back on that, it just didn't seem to gel that that was the case. There was no like foreshadowing that that could have been the case. And there was one key plot point where I was left thinking, oh, really? You know, how could they force her to do that? So it really stretched my suspension of disbelief. It was just stretched a bit too far at several points in the book. So I'm sorry to say, although I'd been very engaged for most of the book and largely enjoyed it, I did feel a bit let down at the end. It just felt as though the author was in a bit of a rush to get all the things together and to get it out. Maybe that was the case. Maybe it wasn't. I don't know. But so that was a bit of a disappointment. I don't know. I think I probably gave it 3. I'd probably make it 3.5 stars out of 5 if I was asked to do that. Yeah. So there you go. That was that one.
All right. Before we go any further, I have to apologise for stating that Leon Garfield was a thriller writer. I got him mixed up with Brian Garfield.
Ah.
I got the Garfield side right, but not the first one. Brian Garfield wrote Hopscotch, but he also wrote the original Death Wish novels, which were turned into sort of revenge thrillers by starring Charles Bronson back in the 70s, I think 1970s. There was a big thing about revenge. That style of revenge film in the 1970s. But it's interesting because the next book I'm going to talk about is a bit of a revenge thriller as well. This one is called Razorblade Tears by S.A. Cosby from 2021. Mentioned it earlier in the podcast when I said that it had been shortlisted for the International Thriller Writers Award. This is his follow-up to his successful Blacktop Wasteland, which I read at the end of 2020. I enjoyed, but I had a lot of reservations about it, and some of those reservations are still here. I had a look this morning and I gave Blacktop Wasteland 3.4 out of 5, but this one's better. I've given this one 4. Now, that earlier book, 4.0 out of 5, that earlier book picked up a few awards. It got a lot of mentions around all over the place because the action in it was frenetic. I mean, he does the action and the characters really well. I was just a little bit worried about some of the setup in terms of how he got there. It just was piled on too much. But anyway, this one is a bit of a step up in intensity and action and style, in my view. So I did enjoy it. Now, it revolves mainly around two major characters. Ike, who's nicknamed Riot, gives you an idea of what he's up to, Randolph. So generally he's called Riot Randolph, but he's not called that anymore at the start of this particular book. Now, he's African-American. And the other one is Buddy Lee Jenkins, who's white. Now, these are the fathers of two young men, Isaiah and Derek. These are two gay men who married about a year before the novel starts and have recently been murdered in a gangland-style execution. So they've been basically shot and then two extras into the head and when they're on the ground. Now, Ike and Buddy Lee are both ex-convicts. Ike got in for was in for manslaughter. Buddy Lee was, I don't know, probably theft or misuse or fraud or something. So they both, but they first meet at the funeral. They hadn't met each other before. Both fathers were estranged from their sons. And Ike and Buddy Lee don't like each other on sight. I mean, they're complete opposites. This book is set in sort of Richmond, Virginia, so, and it's got a lot of rural Virginian background. There's a racial undercurrent that cuts through this, you know, really, really sharply. So you've got a, basically, he's set up as a white redneck on the one side with Buddy Lee and an African-American who's done good. He's done well after he's come out of prison. He runs his own landscaping business. So he's done very well. Buddy Lee is living in a trailer, divorced, on his own, and he's just a complete mess. But the two of them join up to hunt down their son's killers after the police investigation effectively stops. The cops just run out of clues. They don't know what to do. And then the son's gravestone, which is a dual gravestone, is broken and desecrated. And the two of them decide that, right, we're going to find out what happens. So it's sort of like a buddy movie of complete opposites of these mm-hmm. two people. What they have in common is their prejudices. They're just prejudiced against, they have some prejudices the same and some that look the same but just come from opposite sides. So they hate each other because one's black, one's white, for one thing. But they also hated what their sons were, namely homosexual. They could not deal with that at all. And that's the two things that you need to remember in this particular book, that where it starts and where it finishes are completely different places. So the journey that they have in this particular book is not just about revenge and redemption. The book's about the two men and how their journey goes from their mutual hate and their mutual but opposite prejudice for each other and for their sons to slowly coming to an understanding of each other and of where their sons were and what they and who they were. Neither of them, when they start, can accept the relationship of their sons nor what they had become when they came out as homosexual. But as we're all fully aware that blood really overrides all of these prejudices. And the two men start to make some headway in their investigation. So the action slowly starts, after a little bit of setup, the action then starts running thick and fast as the two men basically smash and shoot their way through to a final solution. Now, I thought that solution of who killed the young men was rather pat. It was just didn't seem, it fitted what had been done, but it just seemed too contrived mm-hmm. about how it all fit together and with everything. But it's more about the journey that the two men take to get to that final part that's really of interest here. And the slow, steady change in the two of them as they start to develop a level of mutual respect and a loathing for the men and the fathers that they used to be. They slowly become more of a rounded human being. They're not all the way there, but they've started to go there, and they start to see who their sons were and what they were doing, and they start to respect them for that and come to the view that it was none of their bloody business what they were doing and who they fell in love with. It wasn't their point. Now, you don't want to come to this particular novel looking for literary introspection and precision in terms of its writing. You're just not going to get that here. The action is coarse and rough, so is the dialogue and so is the writing. But it fits. It just fits the style and it fits the novel itself. So this, as I said earlier, this is a better novel than Blacktop. He does really good titles, by the way.
No, he has great titles.
Razorblade Tears is just fantastic. And then you get to anything. Oh, okay. So they're crying tears for their sons and cuts them like a knife because of everything, you know. And I reckon Cosby has all the tools to make an excellent Southern Noir writer. I think he just needs to get his plotting into shape a little bit more. He needs to put a little bit more effort into that to make that a little bit more venturesome, a little bit more unexpected. But in any event, I'll be keeping an eye on this guy's journey. I think he's going places. This is going to be a wild ride, I can tell you. Now, both of these books, Blacktop Wasteland and Razorblade Tears, have both been optioned for films It's very easy to see why. The first one's got a lot of car chases in it, so that's obvious. Big screen stuff. That'll go down well. And the first one had practically all lead characters were African American, so that will be a difference in style as well. So this, if you like, you can put this down as a revenge buddy movie. Those buddy movies that used to be around where they'd put two completely opposite people together and put them in and then just let them bash each other's heads together. It's sort of a bit like that, but it goes a little bit further, I think, than your normal run-of-the-mill style with that. And there's a lot more here. So an author to keep an eye on.
Sounds good. Okay, my next book is The Torrent by Dinuka McKenzie. Now, this is a debut novel by this writer, and it won the HarperCollins Australia 2020 Banjo Prize, which I think is for an unpublished manuscript. Is that right? Anyway, it's...
too many prizes around. I couldn't really tell you. Banjo Prize. Yeah. He wrote poetry. Banjo Patterson wrote poetry and... I suppose he wrote some short stories, but...
I think he wrote some short stories. Anyway, the prize it won.
All right, fair enough.
So there you go. Anyway, The Torrent. It's a strong police procedural novel, but it was a bit, I would say, low-key for my taste. There's not a lot of dramatic action. There's just steady, determined investigative work by the book's protagonist, who's Detective Sergeant Kate Miles. And it's set in a northern New South Wales town after a devastating flood. Hardly more relevant or to contemporary circumstances, given that they're having terrible flooding at the moment. So very, very much on point for that. So Kate Miles is an interesting character. She's of mixed race, being the daughter of a Sri Lankan mother and a white father, who, before his retirement, was the well-regarded local chief inspector of police. And as the book opens... Kate is heavily pregnant with her second child, with only a week to go before she's due to go on maternity leave. And we see throughout the book how she has to deal with several forms of discrimination, which you can imagine, about her skin colour, about the fact maybe that she got her position because of her father being who he was, about being a woman, about being a pregnant woman. And all of this makes it harder to do her job, but nevertheless she perseveres. So although she's counting down the days to her leave, she's in charge of a team investigating a series of violent robberies of local fast food outlets. In the latest incident, one of the counter staff at a McDonald's outlet was badly assaulted and hospitalised with her injuries. So the police are taking that case very seriously. But at first they're having trouble making any progress, as the offenders, who are likely teenagers, wore rubber masks depicting various Marvel superheroes. So it takes quite a few clever investigations and a bit of luck to eventually crack the case open. But while that investigation is going on, however, Kate is given a semi-secret task by her boss to look into the death of a man during the floods. He and his wife were in a ute which was swept away while trying to cross a flooded section of road. His battered body was found hours later. His wife managed to pull herself out of the water. The coroner declared it an accidental death. But the man's mother is obsessed by the idea that somehow the wife, who she's always hated, somehow used the flood to cover up his murder. And Kate is asked to simply review the investigation to make sure all the I's were dotted and all the T's were crossed to keep this lady happy. On the surface, it all seems straightforward, but then, of course, Kate begins to have doubts about this. Now, there's one character in the book whose motivations I just found difficult to understand. And that's Constable Murchison, who was the policeman who did carry out the original investigation. And when Kate looks at the investigation, she decides it was all done very competently. There's no reason to suspect that Murchison didn't do the right thing. Nevertheless, Murchison becomes very hostile to her and starts essentially to stalk her. And there's a suggestion that Murchison was somehow involved romantically with the wife of the victim, but it didn't seem to be particularly credible or hold up, and it really doesn't kind of explain his hostility. And in the end, that thread just seemed to fizzle out for me. Nevertheless, apart from that, I thought that the book was very competently done. It was well written, had a really strong main character, an interesting story, It wasn't one which was full of thrills or action, other than close to the end, in which there's a rather confused scene, I thought, which I thought could have been a bit stronger in terms of building up the tension to deliver that sort of final punch. But no, by and large, I enjoyed the book, and the author's second novel, Taken, has already been accepted for publication, and I'll definitely be following that one up. So that's mine.
You can only basically go with the idea that you're happy. Well, if you go with the idea that you're happy to read a follow-up book for a debut writer, then they've probably done enough. I mean, some hit it out of the park. And lucky to do so, say, you know, Jane Harper with The Dry.
Yeah.
But it doesn't happen all the time. And you have to allow for the fact that some people take a little while to get everything together. But if you've got to see enough in the debut to want to read the next one, yeah, that's good enough. That carries on. Yeah. Well, I'm next talking about a book which is number one in an author's series, but when I mention the author's name, you'll understand that this is by certainly not no means at all his first novel. The book I'm going to talk about is The Department of Sensitive Crimes by Alexander McCall Smith. Now, this is number one in the author's newish Detective Vague series. It was first published in 2019. It's a big difference, this one, from Razorblade Tears. This one's very much a cozy and a very light read, for which I gave it a 3.4 out of 5. So you may know this particular author more for his famous number one Ladies Detective Agency series set in Botswana, made into a TV series as well. There's about 24, 25 novels in that series. Or his 44 Scotland Street, which again there's about 20 or 25 novels of, or The Sunday Philosophy Club, which there's about 20 or 25 novels in.
Yeah, that's right.
Or any of his many other series. It's meant a virtual word machine. He just churns them out. And he's currently 73 years old. Doesn't seem to be slowing down in the slightest. He's just hacking these things out. I don't mean hacking in this instance where you say he's written them badly. No, not at all. He's a very good and very interesting writer. And I was listening to a podcast interview with him within about the last month. And somebody was incredulous about the fact that, he kept on writing all these books. And he said, I start writing one, I get a bit bored with it. So I move on to another one. I get a bit bored with that and I move on to another one. So he said, I've got four series of books because I write four books at once. And so he works on one. Does enough on that one, and don't know what to do anymore on that. Goes on to the next one, does a bit more on that. By the time he gets to the fourth one, he goes, I'm really interested in that first one again. So he goes back to the first one, and then he works his way through. So he puts out about three or four books a year, but he said he's always got three or four books on the go the whole time. So they're pouring out. And, another author who's set in Scotland. But this Department of Sensitive Crimes is not actually set in Scotland at all, this one. I mean, just the author's there, but Detective Inspector Ulf Varg works for the titular Department of Sensitive Crimes in Malmo, Sweden. Mm. Now, Malmo's interesting because that was the area that the Henning Menkel novels were set. Now, this department of sensitive crimes looks after crimes that are a little too complicated for the local police, but not so complicated that homicide or anti-terrorist police are required. And so they cover such crimes as the stabbing of a man in a street market. He was stabbed in the back of the knee. Odd place to stab somebody. The disappearance of a young man who may not be all he seems, and the possible appearance of a werewolf. They're all very interesting and all very light, and none of these is overly creepy or serious. And the novel seems to spend a large amount of time with Varg talking to one or other of the department's other denizens, talking about anything really. Sometimes it's about the case, sometimes it's about the family, sometimes it's about what they're doing. Smith refers to this series as Scandi Blanc, So it's not Scandi Noir, like, you know, girl with the dragon tattoo and all of those. It's a Scandi Blanc. Okay. So it's completely white and cozy and easy. And that probably describes with all the description that you need. There's nothing noirish about this particular book at all. It's light and amusing in Smith's standard style of concentrating more on the characters and the plots and the events. And if you're worrying about the particular name of the character, Ulf Varg, yes, his name actually is Wolf. Like, okay. Ulf is wolf in Danish, and Varg is wolf in Swedish.
Okay.
So it's just a bit of an in-joke that he's a big bad wolf, but he really isn't. He's just a nice, quiet guy that uncovers, solves cozy little stories. There's two or three in this particular series so far. I'm not sure I'm going to be reading any more. I listened to the podcast. Thought, oh, that sounds interesting. My wife's a big fan. I'm not really. I much prefer Razorblade Tears than this. But
something with a bit of grit.
Mm. It's something with a bit of grit. But look, if you're looking for a nice cozy read that is away from everything that you think is bad, this is a good place to start.
Okay. Just going back on what I was saying earlier about the torrent, I'm reading online that HarperCollins launched the Banjo Prize in 2018 in a quest to find Australia's next great storyteller. So basically it's given to an unpublished manuscript, and they get a publishing contract with HarperCollins in an advance of $15,000. And that's what Dinuka McKenzie won with her book, The Torrent.
$15,000 in an Australian setting is pretty good.
Very good, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, I'll roll on to my next book, which is The Apollo Murders by Chris Hadfield. Now, despite the title of this book, The Apollo Murders, it's really more of a Cold War thriller than a crime novel. But it's a pretty good thriller, and there is at least one murder in it, and quite a bit of violent death as well towards the end. Anyway, The Apollo Murders is written by real-life astronaut Chris Hadfield, who famously performed David Bowie's Space Oddity while floating inside the International Space Station, if you recall. I had thought that this must be the first novel written by an astronaut, and I said so in my newsletter. But Mark Plummer wrote to me to tell me I was wrong. Quote, Buzz Aldrin has co-written two SF novels with John Barnes. Michael Collins has written a novella called Mission to Mars. Mercury 7 astronaut Scott Carpenter has written at least a couple of novels. And William Pogue, who is in Skylab 3, has written a novel with Ben Bova. And there may be a few others. So I stand corrected. Anyway, one thing which, of course, Chris Hadfield does bring to a novel like this is a great deal of credibility about the actual details and experience of spaceflight. And the book is really solid in that regard. And it would be worth reading the book just for that alone, I think. So what's it about? It's an alternate history set in the era of the Apollo landings on the moon, rather similar to the TV series For All Mankind. And it similarly uses the international rivalries of the Cold War, which were running hot at the time, an era of high tensions but not actual warfare between the United States and the then Soviet Union. So the book tells a story about a fictitious Apollo 18 expedition. Real history, of course, ends with Apollo 17 being the last landing on the moon. Now, this Apollo 18 expedition is, however, to be a military mission. It seems the Russians have just launched an orbiting spy platform called Almaz, which is intended to be manned, but which will allow them to take high-resolution photographs of American installations and military activity on the ground. In the story, the Americans want to take a good look at this station before the Soviets put people on board it, as well as maybe trying to disable it. They take up a pair of bolt cutters for that purpose.
That'll do it.
And Apollo 18 is tasked to do this before heading off to the moon, where it will land near to where a robotic Russian rover, Lunokhod, something like that, has been, anyway, where this rover has been exploring, again, to examine it, see why the Soviets are interested in that area, and maybe disable the rover too. So the protagonist of the novel is Zemirius Zemeckis, called Kaz for short. And in a prologue, we find that he was a test pilot who, while flying low during a test mission, has a disastrous high-speed encounter with a seagull, which smashes through his windscreen. He loses his left eye in the accident, and so he's no longer able to pursue his goal of becoming an astronaut himself, for which he'd been training. He is, however, appointed to be the crew liaison for the upcoming Apollo 18 mission. Obviously, the planned attempt to investigate and disable the Russians' Almaz space station goes badly wrong, otherwise there wouldn't be much of a story. Suffice it to say that the astronauts and mission control have to start worrying about how you deal with a corpse in space. I won't go into any more detail about the plot because it gives too much away, but except to say that I thought the book was very well written and engaging. There's plenty of thrills and action. And as I've already said, a good deal of interest in the description of the actual experience of spaceflight. We do discover not too far into the book who committed the one actual murder, but I felt that the motivation of the murderer wasn't fully resolved by the time the book ended. Hadfield seemed to be foreshadowing some deep secret to do with this character, which wasn't actually revealed, really, not that I could see. Anyway. And then there's an author's note at the back of the book and in which Hadfield outlines the facts behind a number of real-life things that he includes in the book, including, rather to my surprise, the Almaz space station, which until then I was certain he'd just made up. No, it was a real thing. And it included one extraordinary bit of equipment on board, which you'll have to read the book to find out, but he tells us was indeed real. It really was equipped with this thing. There was just one passage in the book which I really deducted a lot of brownie points for, and that's early on when Kaz is talking to some scientists, and he asks them a series of, I thought, absurdly naive questions about the moon, things which I thought any school child would surely know, even back then in the 60s or 70s, and certainly any adult who'd taken any interest in space, let alone someone who had just trained as an astronaut and was about to be the mission control in mission control for this particular thing. So I understand that the author was trying to educate the audience about some facts they might not know about the moon, but it just wasn't credible from that character's point of view. I actually came very close to giving up on the book at that point, but I managed to ignore it and move on, and I'm glad I did. It was a good read. Yeah. So yeah, apart from that, it was an interesting and an entertaining, very entertaining read.
I'm starting to get a bit of a feel of a common thread here today, David.
That I'm not quite happy with all of these books, that's true.
No, not so much happy with them, that part of it. More a matter of the fact that we think that the explanation for the solutions when you find out who done it just doesn't seem to ring quite...
Isn't satisfying.
No, you sort of think, that was a bit... that was forced, or, you know, that was a bit rushed, or... There didn't seem to be enough evidence behind it, or didn't seem to fit the character. There's a number of those that we're finding here, and I think it might be a bit of a common thread. And, I wonder whether it's the editors not picking it up properly, or whether the editors pick it up and then the authors say, no, this is exactly the way that I want to do it. I don't know. But anyway, our next book, you can pretty much guarantee this guy's never going to get it wrong. He's not going to set up the motivations properly. He's not going to tie all his loose ends off, and he's going to deliver. He may not necessarily deliver a masterpiece every time, he hasn't here, but he's still worth reading. And I'm talking about a long-term favourite of yours and mine, David, Gary Disher. And his most recent novel, The Way It Is Now, which was published last year. Now, most of the time when Disher puts a novel out, I'm always willing to give it up into the fours. But unfortunately, not this time. It's going to be down about 3.7. So, competent. And I'm comparing him to all his previous work, but I can't avoid it. That's just the way that you are when you're dealing with an author that you like so well and that you've had a good time over. Now, I'm not saying that I didn't have a good time with this, but anyway, let me explain. Now, last few years, Disher has written two sequels to his Paul Hirschhausen novel, Bitterwash Road, that over the last couple of years he's written two more in the series. Now, these are the series of crime novels where Hirschhausen's a country cop set in the mid-north of South Australia. I gather from some inside knowledge I've got, a bit more that I will talk about later on, that he wanted to have a bit of a break from South Australia. And so he, that is Disher, has gone back to writing about the area around where he now currently lives, which is down on the Victorian Mornington Peninsula. He dealt a lot about Mornington Peninsula in his Chalice and Destry novels, which ran from 1999 to 2016 or thereabouts, somewhere around that, novels in that series. All good, all worthwhile you're going back and reading. They're all excellent. But at any event, regardless of where he set the thing, he's still utilising, in this instance, a damaged police officer. So he seems to have that as a thread quite a lot. You remember that Hirschhausen he'd been demoted to a country copper constable because he'd been caught up in a corruption scandal in a outer suburban police station, one that he blew the whistle on, but he was sort of, everybody just assumed that he was in it and he was just trying to cover his own backside by basically dobbing everybody else in. In this instance, we're looking at a guy called Charlie Derowin. Anyway, the novel starts in the year 2000 when Charlie Derowin's a young probationary police officer who's involved in a search for a missing 8-year-old boy, Billy Saul, near where he lives. He's been brought down to that particular area, down by the coast in Victoria Peninsula, to carry out a search. And this is the day when Charlie Derowin is out searching for Billy Saul when Charlie's own mother goes missing near the family beach shack. Her car is later found crashed with blood inside, not a lot, but around the keys and the steering wheel, and her belongings have been strewn down the road. She's believed to have been missing, but her body and also the body of young Billy was never found. That's the end of the first section. 20 years later, and Charlie is back living in the beach shack on enforced leave from the police station and dealing with a marriage breakdown. He got involved with a juror in a rape trial he investigated, and their relationship and the juror's digging into the case in her spare time caused the magistrate to declare a mistrial. Now, Charlie was blamed for that, and when he was accused of misconduct, it led to a physical altercation with a senior police officer and suspension from the force. This police officer had actually a bit of a connection through to the person who had been accused of the rape and was of the view that this kid who'd been accused of the rape would never have done it because he came from a good family. AFL football clubs were going around him, trying to draft him. Anyway, so the physical altercation is he pushes the senior police officer, which of course you're not allowed to do, and so he's suspended. So Charlie's sitting at home, biding his time, trying to decide if he wants to stay with the police, but also continue his long-term private investigation into his mother's disappearance. But he's also negotiating the fraught relationship between his homosexual brother on the one side and his ex-police officer father on the other, while also he's trying not to mess up his own love life. He's sort of trying to keep in contact with his ex-wife, but he's also trying to have the relationship with this juror that he seems to be going along with quite well. And then two bodies are found in the same makeshift grave near to Charlie's house and near to where his mother went missing. Now, the reader, it's not a stretch for the reader to figure out who the two bodies are pretty much straight away. And so the difficulty becomes in trying to work out who put them there and why. Now, Disher always writes an enjoyable book with a compelling plot, realistic settings and detailed characterisations. But somehow or other, this novel just doesn't seem to have the spark of his earlier work. There's something, just not, for me, just not right there. I don't know what it is. I can't work it out. So none of the male characters are likeable at all. The women are all great. There's, the Charlie's girlfriend, his father's new partner, new wife, and the other women in in the novel are all good. They're all fantastic. But none of the male characters are particularly likeable. They've all got power issues and they're all trying to... They're all basically extremely self-centered and trying to just look after themselves and be very, very selfish. And there's also a bit too much GPS-inspired driving in this particular novel. It tends to get a bit repetitive and tedious. I mean, he does tell you, I turned down this road and this road and that road and this road and this road. And you can always follow him if you wanted to, line it up on a Melways map and just draw the line. Oh, he went down to the... Oh, that's where the house is that he's gone to. Just a bit too much, I think. Just
too much detail, yeah.
Just a bit too much detail for that. I mean, I like the idea of you getting getting a view of the setting in terms of where he is, but I think this just went a bit too far over towards one way. So, look, it all comes together well at the end. You know that everything's going to be tied up. You know that it's all actually going to make perfect sense, but I don't think these are up to... he's not really at his best in this one. But look, even if his second level work is better than most novels that are doing the rounds, I'm just being... I think I'm being overly critical here on the basis that his other stuff has been so damn good for so long that I thought this one was just a little bit of a tip away. Now, the other bit of inside knowledge I can give you, David, which I found out about, is that he is lined up to have another Hirschhausen novel out in Australia before Christmas this year. And so that is coming out from Text Publishing, and that will be out before December in time for Christmas. So looking forward to that and see how that one goes. Now, you've read this one as well, haven't you?
I have.
And what do you think of it?
I would agree pretty much with everything you've said about it. There were a couple of things which annoyed me, really. You get a reveal at the end as to what's been going on and who did what, but it's all delivered really from a dying man's confession. I don't think I'm giving too much away to say that. There wasn't really any investigation by the lead character which really uncovered this information. There's a bit, but it's really a matter of pinning it on a particular character, and there's a violent incident, and this character's dying. And you get this long confession as to what had been going on. So I just thought that it was a bit unsatisfying. That's all I would say because of that. It just didn't seem to be the result of clever investigation. So
he sort of stumbles on the solution.
Yeah, he does. He stumbles on the solution and then gets this big long confession from someone.
Yeah.
And there are aspects even of the solution which I think, well, hang on. You know, so for example, the young boy who went missing, he goes missing because he sees something he shouldn't. But during the original investigation in 2000, they find this young boy's togs and things down by the beach, a towel and everything like that. And I'm thinking, okay, if this young boy stumbled on this incident and that's why he got killed, why would the people involved in that incident actually go to the trouble of like faking the kid's death? You know,
they're trying to fake it to say he went for a swim.
Yeah,
and
it just seemed unlikely to me. Anyway, that's yeah, whatever. Anyway, but yes, I was a bit disappointed in it, and I look forward to the next Hirschhausen. One thing I did want to say was that this is the first novel I've read which incorporated our experience of COVID-19. In the story, the Charlie Durvin's father, Rhys Durvin, contracts COVID while on holiday on a cruise ship, and he's hospitalised in Japan. So that when he returns to Australia, he's in pretty poor shape. So it was interesting that, you know, those sort of contemporary things were folded into the novel, I thought.
Yes, that was an interesting part of things. I think we may be being overly critical, but all we can say is we've got some reservations about it. But it's still a good book. If you read this, you're going to enjoy it. You're going to enjoy it.
Yeah.
Yep. Right. Well, getting near the end of things, so I'm just going to have a few comments, David, about a TV series that's been on ABC TV. This is Australian ABC TV, And it's also available for watching on ABC iView, so you can watch the whole lot, the whole series, and binge watch it if you want to over a week, which is basically what I've done. And it's only just come through to the TV. Second episode was on this past Sunday. And it's a series called Troppo, which, according to the credits, is inspired by Crimson Lake by Candace Fox. Now, this is not an adaptation, and I will explain a little bit why, but not completely why, because it'll ruin things. Anyway, if you can remember, it's been a while since I've read Crimson Lake, so I had to go and actually do a bit of work to try and remember what would actually happen, because I've read so many books since then, it's just sort of faded a little bit. But I do remember the characters, and the two main characters are ex-police detective Ted Concaffey, who's left Sydney under a major cloud because he was accused of a serious sex crime, but later released for lack of evidence. He now lives in far north Queensland in the town of Crimson Lake, and it's there that he's approached by local PI and also a convicted murderer, Amanda Farrell, to help her in an investigation into the disappearance of a local scientist slash businessman who is presumed dead. And as I said, this TV series is inspired by the novel, and that it takes the bare bones, the setting, the two main characters, then adds in a number of plot devices and scenarios. But they look as though they've really been designed to appeal to foreign TV markets a bit. For example, Concaffey is no longer a straight Australian, but he's an American-Australian copper, played by Thomas Jane, who was in the Expanse TV series. And the missing man is a Korean scientist rather than a local celebrity author. And so this Korean scientist slash businessman is working for a company in Australia. He's brought his family over from Seoul in South Korea to work in far north Queensland on a method of being able to extract minerals from the ocean seabed. And he goes missing one night, and his wife, that is the Korean scientist's wife, Park's wife, asks Amanda Farrell to look into his disappearance because the cops have got absolutely no idea about what's going on and can't find anything and doesn't seem to make any sense to them. So she decides that she needs a bit of help because she's, even though she says she's a PI, she's never actually investigated anything. And she knows about Concaffey being there and goes to see him. Now, in the book, it's the other way around. Concaffey is convinced by his lawyer to go and see this particular woman to see whether she needs an assistant with anything. And it just so happens that she does because she's got this missing person case. Now, Amanda Farrell is played by Nicole Shamoon, who was in the Safe Harbor TV series where she played a Iraqi refugee and got very good notices for that. It's not a TV series that I've seen. Again, I think it was on ABC, but anyway. Now, it took a while for me to warm up to her, but I eventually got there. But I'm not entirely sure about Thomas Jane, whether he works as Concaffey on... Anyway, there are a number of strange decisions that have been made about this particular series. The hospital and the police station seem to be in old converted houses on the edge of town, not in the middle of town, which I don't quite get. And for a small country town, it seems to have a hell of a lot of industry going on around it. Look, I know that there's cane fields and all the rest of it out there, but it just seems to be, I don't know, it just didn't seem to gel right for me. And I also think the TV series is probably a bit too long. It's eight 1-hour episodes, so that's 8 hours worth from one novel. I reckon if it was six, I reckon it would have been tighter and it would have been better, because I think they've just tried to stretch it a little bit too far. Look, it's an interesting series. It's worth watching. If you don't know the book at all, I don't know how you think about this particular series if you haven't read the book. You probably think it all hangs together really well.
You might like it better if you haven't read the book.
You might like it better. But if you have read the book, don't expect a strict adaptation of the novel. Not at all. Now, the other thing that I wanted to mention quickly is that the opening sequence is pretty good, and it actually reminds me very much of the opening title sequence for the original True Detective series with Woody Harrelson and Matthew McConaughey from 5 or 6 years ago. It may well have been done by the same people, but it's got the same sort of feel, same sort of look to it. It's good. It suits the atmosphere they're attempting to create with this particular TV series. And so the whole thing looks very, very professional. I just wasn't overly convinced that it worked, that's all. And that may well be because I've read the book and I like the book so much. I thought we were going to be getting an adaptation of it, but we haven't. So it's inspired by it, and that's about all I can say, really. I gave it 3.4 out of 5, so.
Okay, it's fine. I've only seen the first episode, so I shouldn't really comment.
The first episode's a lot of setup, so it's not really all that good. The second episode is a lot better, and I had really high hopes for it after that. Although I was still trying to remember what went on in the book to see whether it fitted, but in the end, I had to throw the whole thing out.
Maybe you just have to set that aside and just treat it as a thing in itself. Yeah.
So I think that's probably the best. If you just look at it as okay, let's just look at this as being inspired by it, and then. That's what we've got. We've got the characters and we've got the setting and we've got a missing person. And basically, that's it. And then we roll on. Hopefully, they'll make the next couple. Mm-hmm. But I haven't heard anything as yet.
Well, I guess it'll depend on how well this one goes down.
Yes, but I guess we'll see. I guess that's probably what's going to happen. Hopefully, my review of it doesn't kill it. I very much doubt that.
I doubt it too.
No. Look, as I said, I think it's basically because I was expecting more of a closer adaptation of the of the book. But if you're happy to go with a TV series that is inspired by rather than adapted from, then you're probably going to be fine with this.
Sure, indeed. Mm. All right, I think we've probably talked enough about crime today.
I think so. I think we've come through about the end. Yeah,
indeed. So unless you had anything more to say, no.
No, I think I've talked about crime enough for a little while.
So. Okay, so next time we're going to be talking about science fiction again because we're going back in the Hugo time machine to the year of 1968. And that'll be an interesting look at some books which are coming out in what you're sort of pretty much new wavy sort of era.
Yeah, well, it's the... so this is the 1968 Hugo Awards covering the year of 1967. Mm. So it's the second or third year of the Nebulas as well. It was the year of... the big book that year, I guess, is Dangerous Visions that was edited by Harlan Ellison. Monstrous original anthology of science fiction and science fantasy and fantasy stories. Bit of a groundbreaker. And we will be discussing some stories from that particular anthology in our next episode, along with the other winners.
Indeed. Sounds good.
All right.
Cool. All right, Perry. So we'll catch you all next time, which will be in 3 weeks' time. On the 28th of March, we'll see you again.
Yep, okay. Well, thanks, David.
Thanks, Perry.